My guest tonight is a young academic who is in a fascinating field, namely the study of religion. Not the study of theology, but religion as human thought, as human symbolic system, and the history of religion, and the current status of religion. And not merely a religion, but all of the major religions, at least, maybe some of the minor ones as well. We shall shortly determine that in conversation with Stephen Prothero, who is the chairman of the Department of Religion at Boston University. The new book from which we are drawing is titled Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know and Doesn't. As I've been reading this, it occurred to me that a very common thing we are familiar with is the little gag about the guy in the museum who says, I don't know anything about art, but I know what I like. It occurs to me that many Americans, if you are right, and I think you are, could just as easily say, I don't know anything about Christianity, but I know what I believe.
Well, I think that's true. I'm not sure they could say, I know what I believe. They could say at least, I know in what I have faith, or I have faith in Jesus, and I don't really care what he said. That could be the case. I think there is a distinction between faith and knowing, and I think the gap has become broader over the course of American history. They used to be intimately connected, and not so much anymore.
Is it really true that if you ask the average confessing Christian who says, I am a Christian, and even I'm a fundamentalist Christian, if you ask him to, say, recite the Decalogue, he can't do it? He may not know what the Decalogue refers to?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, what's the Decalogue? Which is the Ten Commandments. That's absolutely true. People have a hard time, Christians and Jews, yeah, and other people of faith have a hard time reciting the Ten Commandments. I find my students, I give this quiz that's in my book to my students every year at the beginning of my introductory religion courses.
Your religious literacy quiz.
My religious literacy quiz that's in the book, and they have a heck of a time with the Ten Commandments. They can sometimes do honor your father and mother if they're Catholics. That's been beaten into them sometimes. And they can sometimes do, you know, don't commit adultery, those sorts of things. But they have a hard time with the Ten Commandments.
Well, I started in my pre-introduction to the program tonight by raising some of those very questions. It occurs to me that we might give more of them and then ask people to phone in their answers. And the first one who gets the answers right will get a free copy of your book. How's that as a deal?
That sounds like a great deal.
Now, I'm going to give you back your book, because you should bring a copy yourself, but I've been reading it, and I've got it right here. We can't use all of these questions, because some of them would require answers that are too lengthy, but you read those questions, choose some 7 or 8 of them, and present them to our audience, and we'll invite listeners, as soon as they think they know the answers to all 7 or 8, to phone in at 591-7200, and the first person who gives us correct answers to all 7 or 8 questions will get a free copy of this very book.
You want me to do that right now?
Yeah, please. Starting from the beginning. The ones that can give you, say, a full list of the Ten Commandments, things of that sort, but the ones that have a simpler answer.
Well, here's one. Name a sacred text of Hinduism. This is one that's pretty difficult for a lot of people. Just name one.
A sacred text of Hinduism.
There's a lot of them. What's the name of the holy book of Islam?
Mm-hmm.
That's a little easier. This is a little trickier. President George W. Bush spoke in his first inaugural address of the Jericho Road. What Bible story was he invoking? What's the Bible story of the Jericho Road?
Go back to the very beginning of the set of questions.
Well, name the four Gospels.
That's right. I read that. I read some of those as we started tonight. Name the four Gospels.
Name the four Gospels. That's something amazingly a lot of people have a hard time. Most Americans can name, barely a majority can name one.
Mm-hmm.
But that's difficult for a number of people. Where, according to the Bible, was Jesus born? What are the first 5 books of the Hebrew Bible, or what Christians call the Old Testament? And then, let's see, I only have one left. How about this one? This is one of my favorites. How about God helps those who help themselves? Is this in the Bible? And if so, where? God helps those who help themselves.
Great. That's the set.
That's seven right there.
Yep. 7, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And so you've heard all of those. You want to repeat them quickly? Can you do that?
Sure. Name the four Gospels. List as many as you can. Name a sacred text of Hinduism. What's the name of the holy book of Islam? Where, according to the Bible, was Jesus born? President George W. Bush spoke in his first inaugural address of the Jericho Road. What Bible story was he invoking? What are the first 5 books of the Hebrew Bible or the Christian Old Testament? And God helps those who help themselves. Is this in the Bible, and if so, where?
Wonderful. Those questions are now out there, and if you think you know the answers to all of them, do by all means phone in. The first person to phone in with all the correct answers will get a free copy of the book by Stephen Prothero. Maggie will be fielding your calls, and as soon as we've got a winner, we'll probably get the winner on the air, if only for a moment or two.
That sounds good. I'm thinking we should be giving the book to people who do badly on the quiz, since one of the points is to try to educate ordinary people about some of these basic things.
They should go buy the book, of course. But how bad is it, really? You've surveyed, you've given this quiz to your own students. Have you done any broader surveys, or do we have data collected by yet others which indicate just how religiously illiterate Americans are?
Well, we don't have a lot of data compared to, there's a tremendous amount of data on what Americans believe, how many Americans believe in God, also how many Americans go to church or synagogue or mosque each weekend. We have a lot of data on the beliefs and behaviors of Americans, very little data on the knowledge, religious knowledge of Americans. But there are some surveys, and I went back as part of my research for the book and looked at surveys really from the early 60s on. And the Gallup polls have done some things, the George Barna group has done some things, and I aggregate those in the book. And it really is surprising to see that only about a third of Americans say can name the person who's credited with giving the Sermon on the Mount. You know, that's the sort of thing that when I was a kid, I thought that people just knew whether they were Christians or Jews or whatever, it didn't matter. That's just the sort of thing we knew as Americans.
Isn't the answer Pontius Pilate?
Well, the answer is Billy Graham, according to a lot of people. But no, Jesus is credited.
Literally, Christians don't know that Jesus gave the Sermon on the Mount?
They don't, no. They might know that he said, blessed are the poor in spirit. Uh-huh. They might not know that either. I just think the tradition has really evolved toward more toward feeling and more toward morality and quite away from doctrine and storytelling.
Just as many Americans will tell you, well, I'm not exactly religious, but I'm very spiritual, whatever they mean by that.
Well, I think I know what they mean, at least in part, and I think part of what they mean is that they don't like the institutional church.
Yeah.
They don't like their synagogue they grew up in, and that they think about religion as something that happens inside them, as something that's personal, and not something that has to do with institutions or indeed with dogma or with doctrine or with creed. And I think that is related to the decline in religious literacy.
But religion at that level becomes sort of a warm glow and maybe sort of a vaguely organized, almost pre-verbal justification for self-indulgence.
Well, you said that. I didn't say that.
But don't you think that's
I think the way
it sometimes works?
You know, I do think there's part of that. I mean, you know, this book in a way grew out of my prior book on, which was called American Jesus. And one of the findings there for me that was so intriguing was how Jesus had become a pretty vacuous sort of figure and who could be pushed around and manipulated and used in various sorts of ways, in part because Americans' understanding of him were not rooted in the traditional creeds of the church or even in the Bible.
Well, Jesus has served in American popular preaching, it seems to me, or just in American popular thought, has served as almost a Rorschach blot onto which you can project just about anything. A number of authors have done books about the various Jesuses who have been constructed in modern time. In fact, if you go back to way back to the 1920s, you will remember the book by Bruce Barton, will you not?
I sure will, The Man Nobody Knows.
Yeah. Barton was a famous advertising man in the 1920s, and he made Jesus into a great advertising man.
That's right, and this is what we tend to do. We tend to project our own ideas out there. And, you know, it is a little troubling, and it makes me think that not only when it comes to Jesus, but with other forms of religion, you sort of wonder what's the doctrinal, what's this narrative basis that's there, and is this just a freelance project where we can just project our feelings onto these key symbols
in their various religious
traditions?
That relates, of course, doesn't it, to a very interesting scholarly enterprise that has been underway for 200 years or so and has been revived in recent years, certainly, namely, and we do programs on it more than once, the search for the historical Jesus, which has turned up precious little, apparently.
Well, that's one thing that has intrigued me over the years is following that. I follow it not as an expert, but as just a general reader. And I have always been struck at how current so many of these Jesuses seem. I know that one thing that got me interested in that American Jesus project a few years ago was looking at the Jesuses that were being written up by these scholars in books that were really formed, I think, in the gestalt of the 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. and reminded me of the Beats. I just, you know, Jesus would be described as this guy who left his mom and quit his job and went out on the road with a bunch of guys and had fun. And it just sounded to me like Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg.
Or like the musical Jesus Christ Superstar.
Sure, I mean,
they treated him just that way.
Right, and also reading him through the hippie movement. That's right, mm-hmm. that's right. But the broader question you raise about, you know, once doctrine and storytelling go away, what's really there? This is something that troubled George Santayana, the Harvard philosopher, who used to talk about American culture as a place of fairly vapid and, you know, feeling that was unconnected to the great ideas of the world. It's sort of the typical, maybe egg-headed thing you might expect a philosopher to say. But I think there is some truth to that when it comes to religion, that Americans really do play fast and loose. And one way they play fast and loose is by forgetting about the doctrines and the stories that inform their religious traditions.
Is that possibly, however, why Americans by self-report are, quote, are so much more, quote, religious than are Europeans these days? Americans really, for example, do go to weekend services, whether the synagogue on Saturday, the church on Sunday, or for that matter, the mosque on Friday. And they do this much more, at least the Jews and Christians do this much more than do their opposite numbers in the Western European nations.
Yeah.
Maybe because their religion is easier to take because it's less specified and less doctrinaire.
Well, that could be. That's the more generous way of saying it. The less generous way of saying it is that part of the reason why Americans are so religious is indeed because they don't know anything about their tradition. And if they were more like Europeans and they had religious education all through their youth, which most people in Europe do, they might generate some skepticism that would keep them away from the church. I'm skeptical about that view. I think it's possible to be religious and heartfelt in your faith and also knowledgeable about your faith. And I don't know, maybe I'm revealing some of my Episcopalian background with that thought, but I hope it's not too Pollyanna to imagine that that's a possibility.
A basic question arises. It's a question that challenges the very significance of or the very relevance of your book. You say, you are really saying Americans are comparatively culturally unlettered. That is, religiously unlettered. They are, they lack true religious literacy, which is what your book is about. The question that I press upon you right now as we pause for some commercials, looking forward to your answer in 3 minutes, is so what? What's so great about religious literacy? Why do we need it? What is not available in life if you're not religiously literate? We return directly to Stephen Prothero, author of the new book, Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know and Doesn't, after these words. And my special guest of the evening is Stephen Prothero, who is the author of the new book, Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know and Doesn't. And we've got a winner of our religious literacy quiz, and we'll go directly to him on the phones. Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
You have answers. Give us the answers to those 7 questions.
Well, the first question was, what is the holy book of the Hindus?
Yes.
One holy book. I said the Vedas.
All right.
The second answer question was, the answer was the Quran.
The Quran for the holy book of Islam, yes.
That's right. The third question was, this was a Good Samaritan story.
Yes.
The Jericho Road, President Bush in his first inaugural.
Yes.
That's right.
Sir, I think hold on a minute, you've got your radio on. Turn it off, please, that's what's confusing you.
I'm sorry.
Just listen to us on, you can just handle it all on the telephone right now. But that's getting in your way.
And okay.
All right, now let's continue. The Jericho Road story, go ahead, please.
Could you remind me of the third question, please?
Name the four Gospels.
The four Gospels, yes. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
And then where was Jesus born, according to the Bible?
Bethlehem, of course.
Of course. And what are the first 5 books of the Hebrew Bible?
First 5 books. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and Numbers.
Okay. And then God helps those who help themselves. Is this in the Bible?
No, it is not.
Any idea who said that?
I hear it all the time, but I'm not sure who said it.
It's Ben Franklin.
Ben Franklin.
That's
okay.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
Now back to that Jericho Road story. What's the question on that one?
President George Bush spoke in his first inaugural of the Jericho Road. What Bible story was he invoking? And I think the gentleman said the Good Samaritan.
So we have that.
That's true.
That's right.
So you win. And Maggie has your name and address, I gather.
Thank you very much.
All right. We thank you. You'll be getting a copy of this book sent to you by the publisher.
Great show, by the way.
Well done.
Thank you, sir. Well, there's one religiously literate fellow out there.
There you go. There you go. If the whole country was like that, nobody would be interested in my book.
But now, that just gives me a chance to reinstate the question I put to you just a few minutes ago. Why is that important? In what way is he, as a religiously literate person, more benefited than somebody who can't answer
those
questions?
Well, I think there's two ways to go at that. There's the personal side, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of us have had the experience of being in a conversation with a friend or being in a conversation with a child and running up short against our own understanding, particularly of our own religious tradition, when a child will ask, you know, why are we doing this particular holiday today? Or I heard somebody say, Jesus said this, did Jesus really say that? And we all would have the experience, many of us at least, of wanting to know more and knowing that we don't know more. And so that's a problem interpersonally that you might just feel if you're having a conversation about, say, gay marriage with friends and somebody brings up the Bible, you might feel you can't really continue with the conversation because you don't know what the Bible says about homosexuality, and so you can't do it. So that's the personal side, and the book tries to address that with this Dictionary of Religious Literacy at the back. But the real emphasis of the book really is on the civic and political side of this. And here I think you can divide it into two arenas. First is the arena of American politics. It used to be the Republicans were really the ones who were keen on talking about Jesus and God and religion in the public space. But since the 2004 election, when that seemed to be such a good strategy politically, the Democrats are getting involved. And so we have now both parties really running into politics with religious reasons. And so insofar as we want to understand what's going on in American politics and we want to be engaged with American politics, we need to know something about religion in order to engage these politicians, both on the left and the right, when they say things like, the Bible is opposed to gay marriage, the Bible thinks Roe v. Wade was a bad idea or was a good idea, or Christianity is opposed to capital punishment, or, you know, the Iraq War is not a just war. You know, these are all arguments that are being made on the basis of religion. And we as citizens can't engage the arguments unless we know something about religion. And we can't make judgments about our politicians unless we know something about religion too. So that's the problem. It's a problem of democratic participation, really, for me. And then the other one, which is really more serious in a way and more scandalous in a way, has to do with international affairs. And it has to do with understanding what's going on in Iraq, understanding what's going on in Iran, understanding what's going on in Kashmir, and looking at our politicians and saying, what do these people know about, say, Sunnis and Shiites? Why are they surprised that Iraq is erupting in sectarian violence? And we know that after 9/11, there were very few people in the State Department who spoke Arabic. We know that Sylvester Reyes, the Democrat from Texas, who's running the House Intelligence Committee now, a few weeks ago was asked, is Al-Qaeda a Sunni or a Shiite group? He had no idea. I find this not just scandalous, but really scary. You know, who's... You know, what kind of religious knowledge are these people using? And isn't it the case that to understand these international conflicts, you have to understand something about religion? I think you do. And I think our politicians are falling short. And we as citizens who need to hold these politicians accountable need to know something about religion in order to do that part of our job.
Here's something that really probably would confound many Americans who heard it but could not have understood it unless they had done some special reading on the basic precepts of Shiite Islam. When Ahmadinejad said, as he did a few months ago, Israel will end soon and everything will come to a great historic transformation because the occulted imam is shortly to reappear. Did they know what he was talking about?
Well, no, they don't. And this is where, you know, this is the idea in Shiite Islam that there is this hidden imam, you know, you call the occulted imam, that's a sort of a messianic figure, like Christians would say a second coming figure. And
it's very much a second coming idea.
Well, it is a second coming idea, and this fuels a kind of apocalypticism or expectation of a kind of grand good-evil battle at the end of times that can then fuel martyrdom, bombings, and things like that. And it's very important to understand, you know, you can be sort of secular and say, it's ridiculous that people are so religious. People should be rational and reasonable. They should be making decisions on the basis of, you know, stuff that's real. And I get emails since my book has come out from people saying, well, why should we be talking about fairy tales and craziness? You know, we should be talking about reason. But the reality is that religion matters. Religion matters in the lives of individual people. It matters in American politics, and it really matters overseas. And if we don't understand the basics of Buddhism and Hinduism, we can't understand Sri Lanka. And if we don't understand the basics of Shiite and Sunni Islam, we can't understand Iran, we can't understand Iraq.
And if we don't know the Western Bible, the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament, and the New Testament, we very often can't understand one another. I had an occasion years ago just talking with somebody I knew moderately well at some party, I guess it was, way back at Yale University, where you did a degree and where I was an assistant professor before you ever got your degree. And we were talking about the troubled family of somebody else that we knew but who wasn't at that occasion, and the fact that the son was rather rebellious against his parents, particularly his father. And I said, it's really Solomon and Absalom, isn't it? And he said, who are they? And I said, well, you know, King Solomon and his son Absalom. Oh, Absalom. He didn't know, he had no idea what I was talking about. He asked me to explain, and I had to remind him of the Old Testament story of the revolting son, who ultimately is accidentally hanged from a tree as he's riding past the tree, but his long hair, and well, you know the story.
And I thought you were headed initially toward the prodigal son story, which is a much more commonly used notion. And one thing that I did in researching the book was I looked at the congressional record, and I did searches with the help of a graduate student of the congressional record, and I tried to look at what biblical stories, what biblical teachings are involved there to ask the question, empirical question really, what do Americans need to know about the Bible to understand what goes on in the Senate and the House? And I would find stories like the prodigal son and certainly the Good Samaritan, over 1,000 hits on the Good Samaritan, by the way.
And Cain and Abel, I would guess, would show up.
Things like Cain and Abel, but not Solomon and Absalom. So yeah. I might give that guy a pass.
But he was another Yale professor, I was
talking. That's true. But these are you know, Hillary Clinton, when she was talking about immigration legislation recently, she was talking about the Republican effort to make more restrictive immigration, and in fact to require Americans, citizens, to turn in illegal aliens when they come across the border. And she said this would violate the Bible because it violates the Good Samaritan story. And to me, that's a really interesting question. I'm fascinated. I would love to discuss that, you know, whether the Good Samaritan story enjoins us against particular immigration legislation. But we can't even have that conversation. We can't figure out whether Hillary Clinton is being something of a demagogue using religion for political purposes, or whether she actually has an argument, unless we know something about that story. Or when George Bush uses that story as a hallmark of his compassionate conservatism, when he says, when in his first inaugural, when we walk down the Jericho Road and other people are walking by that injured person across the road, we won't walk by, we'll go over and help them. We're compassionate conservatives. You know, if you don't know the story, you can't decide whether he's just engaging in demagoguery or whether he's really making an important point.
At the end of your book, you've got you call it a dictionary of religious literacy. How many items are in here in all, would you say?
Oh, I'm not sure. You're going to stump me. Maybe 150, something like that.
150 thereabouts. And you've got it alphabetically organized. And these are things you're saying, just as E.A. Hirsch says with regard to general cultural literacy, these are things that you should know. You should know something about so you can discuss them with other people. When it comes up in conversation, you'll more or less get the reference. Just staying with the A's for a minute. Abraham, Adam and Eve, Adventism, African Methodist Episcopal Church, Ahimsa, there's a more difficult one, Allah, Al-Qaeda, Apocalypse, Anglicanism, Apostles' Creed, Armageddon, and so on into the B's, Bhagavad Gita, Bible, Black Muslims, Buddhism, born-again Christian, Calvinism, we're into the C's, Roman Catholicism, Christian Coalition, Christmas, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, City Upon a Hill. These are all items that anybody who is culturally and religiously literate would instantly have some meaning that he could quickly derive so that he could discuss it. We're going to do more with that material, with the dictionary of cultural literacy towards the end of the book, and we will presume to ultimately, not presume, rather, we will resume, I was going to say we presume to test further the cultural and religious literacy of our listeners, but we're not going to actually hit them once again with the kind of contest that one of our listeners has already won, but we will be entertaining their thoughts and, for that matter, their questions about aspects of religion that they've heard about but don't quite understand. Or maybe they don't know what some of those terms that I've just run through actually refer to. Ahimsa is probably puzzling most of our listeners at this moment. We return to conversation with Stephen Prothero. Let's go back to the actual dictionary of religious literacy, which you end the book with, and it's some 50 or 60 pages of those items. Ahimsa was the first one we ran into that really sounds rather esoteric. What is it?
Well, before I answer that, and I will, I haven't forgotten. I'm hoping you won't stump me.
Well, I'm not testing
tonight.
You.
But one thing that I do with that dictionary is I try to point out the ways in which particular Bible phrases or characters or beliefs from other religions outside of Christianity are used in American politics,
sure.
Why they matter. So ahimsa, for example, means nonviolence. It comes from a pretty minor religion in India called the Jain religion, J-A-I-N, sometimes pronounced Jain, and it makes its way into Hinduism, where we see it in terms of vegetarianism and not killing animals and things like that. But why it's important in the American context is it's a really huge influence on Martin Luther King,
and
the notion of nonviolence in the civil rights movement. And so his strategy of nonviolent civil disobedience was very much informed by ahimsa. And many civil rights leaders went to India to speak with Gandhi about this concept and how to politicize it and make it work in the American context.
Isn't it true that Orthodox Jains, really Orthodox ones, who live by ahimsa totally and thus cannot destroy any other life form, will, when they walk on the streets, wear a mask over their mouths so as not to accidentally suck in a bug?
That's right.
The bug.
They do the mask, and they also sweep in front of them. They have this ritual form of sweeping where they'll be sweeping bugs out so they don't step on bugs as they move forward.
Yeah.
It's really quite extraordinary effort to not to harm other other beings, including animals.
While we're on the Indian continent, now we're dealing with religious esoterica. Esoteric to us, but quite common in other settings and in other cultures. You've got a definition someplace in here of the rules laid down by the founder of Sikhism. And they're really quite interesting rules, which explain a good deal about why Sikhs walk around in this country, the male Sikhs do, wearing turbans and beards, and very often a kind of a black strap holding the beard, though we often aren't aware of that unless we look closely.
Right. These are the so-called 5 Ks of a particularly large and influential group of Sikhs. And one reason why this was important is right after 9/11, there was a gentleman in Mesa, Arizona, a Sikh gentleman, who was assassinated by a bigot who wanted to kill a Muslim. And he saw this guy with a turban, and he had seen Osama bin Laden on TV, and he thought that, oh, this guy must be a Muslim. And so, right, I discuss how the men in the Sikh tradition will. One thing that also comes up in court cases is they have this kirpan, which is this little ceremonial sword.
A dagger.
They're supposed to wear. This has become the subject of a lot of litigation in schools that have rules about not having weapons. And, you know, is it a weapon? What are the religious freedom issues that are raised? Does the First Amendment protect you bringing this ceremonial dagger? Does it have to be in a sheath that you can't pull out? These kinds of questions.
In fact, you know, that broadens the whole scale of our knowledge of religion itself. When you take fairly sophisticated people and you talk with them about other religions, they will probably certainly mention the top five. They are probably Christian. They mention Christianity. They know of Judaism. They know of Islam by now rather well. And they know of Buddhism and Hinduism. But they don't know of lots of other religions, which really have some may not know of lots of other religions, which also have millions of adherents. For example, what does the ordinary American know of Shinto in Japan, or for that matter, of Jainism in India, or of the Parsis of India? And India, in fact, is a breeding ground for all sorts of religions.
Right, and you know, I have to say, my angle on this, at least in this book, is that some of that lack of knowledge is just really okay. In other words, in a religious studies class in a college, you might want to introduce people to these things mm-hmm. for purely educational reasons. But because my focus here is civic, I don't really discuss the Jains very much. That's probably the only time in the book I even discuss them. And maybe with the Sikhs, there's maybe only one or two references, because they aren't necessary for contemporary American politics. And at least right now, we don't seem to be on the verge of needing to know that much about these groups for international
reasons. Our common culture requires, though, knowledge of Christianity in its particulars.
That's right. And I think...
And in its documentation.
That's right. And that's why my book is not even handed in the dictionary in terms of, okay, there's five great religions, so Christianity is going to have one-fifth of the entries. It doesn't work that way for me, because one-fifth of the scriptural references in the congressional record are not Christian. 95% of them are. And our congressmen are not quoting from the Sikh scriptures, and they're not quoting from the Parsis and from the Jains. And so what I think Americans need to know about the Jain tradition has to do with places where it surfaces in American culture. And some of the minority religions matter, particularly when it comes to court cases about freedom of religion. And one argument I make in the book is that if you don't know anything about, I don't know, say the Hare Krishnas, then you can't really judge whether the Supreme Court is doing a good job when it rules on the Hare Krishnas.
Should Americans who are not Mormons know more about the Mormons than their polygamy in the past and Brigham Young and so on? For example, should they know something about Mormon theology?
I think now they need to. They need to because we have somebody who might become president who's a Mormon. And right now, one of the big questions is, should we elect a Mormon? Who knows? I mean, if we don't know anything about Mormonism, I mean, maybe we shouldn't. If there's a religion that does human sacrifice, we probably don't want to elect that person. Well, do Mormons do human sacrifice? I'll give you the answer. The answer is no. So I don't want to be understood as criticizing Mormonism.
But they aspire to something else that most other Christians do not.
Well, they aspire to becoming divine. I mean, and this is an intriguing piece of Mormon theology. They also have ongoing revelation where they have a president who is also a prophet who can take the words from God and distribute them out to followers. There's a lot of intriguing things about Mormon theology, and as we talk about Mitt Romney, I think one way to go is religion doesn't matter, right? We shouldn't care whether Mitt Romney is a Mormon or whether he's a Hindu or whether, I mean, that's one way to go. The thing that really impresses upon me or that I think about with Romney and with Mormonism is I don't particularly care that much about what religion he is. Mm-hmm. I want to know what he knows about religion. I want to know if he can pass my quiz, because if he's going to be the commander in chief, or if Hillary Clinton's going to be the commander-in-chief, or Barack Obama, I want to know if they know if they have basic religious literacy, and I'm not confident that they do.
But don't you? I would want to know, since he is a Mormon, as was his father, whether he really is a believing, full-fledged Mormon who goes by the precept it's given in Mormon doctrine, quote, as God was, man is, as God is, man may become, which means if you play it right, if you're perfectly loyal, good, noble person in all of your familial life and in all your meeting all of your moral obligations, you will ultimately in the future life be elevated to be a god in another universe, and you will continue to have a corporeal existence with your own wife and even have sexual relations as a god. And our God was once a mortal man, but he followed that long path leading to his godhood.
Okay.
That's pretty interesting theology.
Well, it is. It's fascinating. I'm fascinated to talk about it. I talk about this stuff with my students. It's really intriguing. But here's the deal. I mean, one way to go is that's really goofy. Do we really want a president who believes such crazy things as that? But when you think about it, it's not all that much goofier than, say, Orthodox Christianity, which also has a notion of ascending to a kind of divine status, mm-hmm. or for that matter, Hinduism, whose core aspiration is to realize that we all are already gods ourselves. We just don't know it. We just have this veil of illusion hanging over our eyes. So the notion that human beings can become divine seems strange to us, many of us, but it's really not that strange in the history of religions.
we are due for some commercials. Late for them because I'm far too involved in this conversation. But we will return directly as we continue conversation with Stephen Prothero and drawing from his new book, Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know and Doesn't. When we return, I want to relate this to the general question of cultural literacy and the general low performance of all sorts of Americans on tests of cultural rather than particularly religious literacy, as we continue in conversation after these words. And we do return to Stephen Prothero, continuing our discussion of religious literacy and failings to achieve true religious literacy. You are, of course, inspired by the work of E.A. Hirsch, and you mention him at a number of points in this book. Explain just what E.A. Hirsch was up to and what he found.
Well, Hirsch wrote this best-selling book in the late 1980s, where he made some similar arguments to the ones that I'm making. He was really concerned with the loss of common cultural references and how can we continue as a society, as a country, to have conversations about whatever, particularly to understand literature, I think, but to some extent to understand politics if you don't know what somebody means when they say the serpent in the garden or these kinds of references. I mean, or the Achilles heel. That was really his focus. And he was lamenting the loss of that common culture and saying, what happens in America when we no longer have that?
He appeared on this program just at the time that book appeared. It was 1980, did you say?
87, I believe.
87, that sounds more like it. In fact, together with him was the now wife of the vice president, Lynn Cheney, who had similar interests.
Was she within NEH then, or the National
Endowment
for Humanities?
I believe she was, or she just recently left that post.
Yeah.
And we had a long discussion on this, and I remained in touch with E.A. Hirsch, and I was much impressed by his work, and since I've been an active college teacher all of my life, it occurred to me to start testing my own students on their cultural literacy. Mm-hmm. Regular listeners to this program have certainly heard me carry on about this before, but my trick was to, at the end of the semester, the particular semester in the year when I taught my largest course, which was an undergraduate social psychology course with some 60 or 80 students in it, I would give them a cultural literacy quiz. And the findings were devastating. These are essentially juniors and seniors at the University of Chicago, an unknown American university. Here are the actual items. I just looked this up again today to be sure I had it right. Mm-hmm. What are the dates of the Civil War, the years of the Civil War? What king of France was executed during the French Revolution? Name a novel by Saul Bellow. Remember, at that time, Saul Bellow, who later was a colleague of yours at Boston University, was, of course, a major figure at the University of Chicago. What are the dates of World War I? By dates, one means merely year to year. Who composed the opera Tosca? Who is the president of the Czech Republic? This was back before the Czech Republic split in two. The answer there, of course, was Václav Havel, who was far more famous than the present president of the Czech Republic. What is the capital of Finland? Who wrote the Critique of Pure Reason? You wouldn't expect the boys at the bar to necessarily know that, but college students, you might think, would. Name three 19th century British authors. Name three 20th century American authors. 20th century defined as first half of the 20th century, 1900 to 1950. The findings are devastating. The very first item, which I've mentioned on this program before, give the years of the Civil War, only 1 out of 10 is able to give you 1861 to 1865.
Yeah, I think a lot of people aren't even going to get within 50 years on that.
Oh, I've had it college students, dated as far back as the Revolution, as far forward as World War I. On naming three 19th century British authors, absolutely devastating. Some may be able to eke out Dickens. They will sometimes mention other authors who aren't British, or if British, aren't 19th century. Most of them can't give you three 20th century, first half of the century American authors, though there's such a rich panoply of possibilities there. Faulkner, Hemingway, even Sinclair Lewis, and on and on and on. The king who was executed in the French Revolution, not one could come up with Louis the 16th. My favorite was, who's the composer of Tosca? And only 1 or 2 out of 50 or 60 can come up with that, but you get some wonderful inventive responses. Some mentioned Beethoven, some mentioned Bach, but the greatest answer ever, one semester, because I use this quiz a number of times, was Tosca was written by Toscanini, which deserves a credit just for its inventiveness.
For its cleverness, yes.
Yeah, but...
But, you know, here's a point I want to make about this, is that my quiz is a lot easier than that, you know, or my quiz is even more basic than that.
Yeah,
I mean, my quiz, I'm trying to think of what the cultural...
Remember, I'm giving this to advanced undergraduate students at a major American university.
Right. I'm trying to think what the parallel would be in the cultural space. You know, I don't know, but my questions are easy.
They're easier than
my questions are really, really easy. They're the sorts of things that, you know, it's shocking to think that you could go to a church for 20 years and not be able to say the four Gospels or Matthew, Mark,
Luke,
and John.
All the same, the point I mean to make, and this is why I brought in this stuff of mine, is that the failure in religious literacy is part of a far larger pattern of general cultural illiteracy, which needs to be blamed in some part upon what the culture has done in transforming the art of reading into the art of gluing yourself to a television set, and needs, of course, also to be blamed upon the poor and the ever-diminishing quality of American public education, whether in the elementary and high schools, but even into the universities. My thesis, you may disagree. I look forward to your response after we pause, as we do in an instant, for a full update on the news. And Stephen Prothero, I was putting to you an hypothesis. I did it rather breathlessly as we were rushing towards the 10 o'clock news hour, or news break, rather. But just quickly reinstated, I think in general we see a kind of cultural decline with regard to literacy in this country, maybe in the Western world generally. It has something to do with the media revolution. It has something to do with the massification of higher education, I think, if massification is an acceptable neologism. And either way, we just don't turn out people as well-lettered as once we did when they got their BAs and left college.
I think that's true. And in my book, I do try to address both the high school and middle school education question and the secondary and higher education, both. But I think you alluded to the fact that the shift from print to visual culture is part of what's going on here.
Surely.
And I think that that's definitely part of it. But I guess I have faith that on the religious literacy front, that if we're headed toward, which we obviously are, toward visual culture and the internet, that we can use those media to teach religious literacy. I mean, there's programming that people are doing to teach the Bible to kids through television shows. I mean, we don't have to give up the ghost here if we say that this kind of literacy is tied to print. It doesn't have to be.
But we run into another question and another problem, which I'm sure you're more than familiar with. That is, those who are really angry about religion and think that it corrupts and spoils life. Listen to some quotations. The leading sort of impassioned intellectual atheist of our time, possibly, is Richard Dawkins of London, rather of Oxford, isn't he? A few Dawkins quotes, and he's the great popularizer of evolutionary theory, and he does that wonderfully well, I would say. He's been a guest on this program, in fact, I think twice. A few quotations. To fill a world with religions of the Abrahamic kind is like littering the streets with loaded guns. Do not be surprised if they are used. Another quote. Are science and religion converging? No. There are modern scientists whose words sound religious, but whose beliefs on close examination turn out to be identical to those of other scientists, who straightforwardly call themselves atheists. To an honest judge, the alleged convergence between religion and science is a shallow, empty, hollow, spin-doctored sham. I'm against religion because it teaches us to be satisfied with not understanding the world. Let me offer you another quotation. The day will come when the mystical generation of Jesus, by the Supreme Being as his father in the womb of a virgin, will be classed with the fable of the generation of Minerva in the brain of Jupiter. Now, that, by the way, is not Dawkins. It is none other than Thomas Jefferson in a letter to John Adams.
Well, good. First of all, Thomas Jefferson knew a lot about religion, and if Americans could be as educated...
He put together a Bible without God, didn't he?
Well, he put together an anti-supernatural Bible, that's right, the Jefferson Bible. But if all Americans knew as much as Jefferson did about religion, I would have no complaint. He was a very well-educated man. He was actually one of the first people in American history to take a real interest in Asian religions. His correspondence with John Adams is quite extraordinary.
So your basic message then is not more religion out there. Let's have more religious faith. Your basic urge what you're urging upon all the rest of us is simply, let's know more about religion.
Well, you can't make the critique that you just read by Dawkins about the virgin birth and Jesus and his father and all this without knowing about the Trinity, without knowing about the doctrine of the virgin birth, maybe not without knowing about the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. In other words, you can't even get up. Dawkins isn't going to have followers unless there's people who are religiously literate who know enough about religion to say that it's a sham.
But you have a direct recommendation to which this book is dedicated, towards which it is pointed, and that is, let's put a course on religion and back into the curriculum, even at high school level and certainly at the college level. And those, of course, that's the kind of course you do at Boston University.
Doesn't that
bring a lot of opposition from some of the organized atheists of the world?
Well, my proposal in the book is for a course about the Bible in high school and a course about the world of religions, two courses. I also call for requirements in higher ed of religious studies, one course. But I was actually on another radio program back in Boston a while ago talking about this, and who called in but none other than Daniel Dennett, who's another one of the famous atheists.
Yes, he's also been on this program. He's got a recent atheistic book.
And he called in and he said, I think this is a great idea. We need courses like this in the high schools because people need to know about religion. It's a very important thing. Similarly, Susan Jacoby, who's another one of this crew, wrote a book called Free Thinkers. She did a review of my book recently and said that she was quite taken with the book. And so you don't have to be a believer to think religious literacy is a good idea. You don't have to be an atheist to believe religious literacy is a good idea. I'm not talking about having faith. I'm talking about having knowledge about religion. You can use that knowledge to become a born-again Christian. You can use that knowledge to stay an Orthodox Jew. You can use that knowledge to become a skeptic. The key thing is to know something about it.
There is yet another perspective, and it's one that interests me and has involved me on and off over the years as a social psychologist, and that is that religion is cultural material. It's part of history. To understand how religions arise, to understand what religious ideas spread and succeed, whereas others fail and are merely classed as heresies and disappear, to understand religion as part of social history and social process is always a challenge. One of the great works of Western sociology is, of course, Max Weber's The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. He is there, whether correctly or otherwise, explaining that capitalism arose because of a precondition which had already been established, and that precondition was the ethos laid out in the Lutheran Reformation. Without it, capitalism would not have occurred, says he. And I'm not going to rehearse or reproduce his argument, but it's a very well-argued, carefully documented sort of argument. One of the people he quotes, in fact, as you know, rather heavily, is Benjamin Franklin, as a great exemplar of the Protestant ethic.
Right, and Weber actually roots his argument for capitalism in Calvinist theology rather than Lutheran theology. But the point you make is still well taken. The key feature there in Weber is religious ideas have historical effects. And, you know, I make this point at the beginning. I do a sort of 5-page run-through of American history. And I go through and I talk about how you can't understand the Civil War, for example, which we've been talking about, without understanding the debates that went on about slavery that were biblically based.
One thing you spent a good deal of time on at some points in the book, and about which one really needs to know if you want to understand the history of these United States, is the various Great Awakenings.
Well, that's right. There are a couple historical chapters that some readers might skip over if they're not interested in American history. I happen to be a historian of American religion, so I care about it. And I was really interested to know, when did religious illiteracy happen? Because Americans used to be amazingly religiously literate. They used to learn passages from the Bible by heart, and then they would have put before them the text on the page, and they would learn how to read because they already knew the Sermon on the Mount, and they would see the words that would match up with the Sermon on the Mount. And so basic literacy and biblical and Christian literacy rose together and were together in both the colonial and the early national period.
What happened during the First and during the Second Great Awakening?
Well, the First Great Awakening, it doesn't figure so prominently in my book. That happens in the 1730s and 1740s. One argument that's made about that is that this big revival that happens up and down the eastern seaboard in the colonies helps to knit together colonists, so they have a consciousness of themselves as Americans that becomes very important in helping to foment the revolution. But the key awakening for me is the Second Great Awakening of the early 19th century in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s. And in this awakening, you have the rise of evangelicalism, which is the dominant, really, Christian ethos since that time. And evangelicals really are Christians who care, I think, or come to care more about feeling and morality than they do about doctrine and storytelling. And the rise of evangelicalism, ironically, because we associate this with, obviously, heartfelt religion, is one of the sources for religious illiteracy in my historical reckoning in the book.
Why so? How does that happen?
Well, evangelicals care a lot less about understanding God through the head than did the Calvinists and the Puritans of the colonial period, who believed that that God spoke to us through the Bible, that God gave us our brains, that we were supposed to, you know, read the book of nature, science, against and alongside the God's word that's provided to us in Scripture. And evangelicals care a lot less about, historically, about, I think it's fair to say, reason, about even ironically text, but certainly doctrine, and even the narratives of the Bible. What becomes important is having a relationship with Jesus. It becomes more psychological, it becomes more heartfelt, and it becomes more individualistic.
It's a cycle that shows up in the history of many religions. For example, essentially the same revolutionary transformation occurs in Judaism through the Hasidic movement as it arose in the 18th century, which is a movement which puts aside biblical exegetical nicety and scholarship and argues it's all in feeling, it's all in the sense of community and the communitarian relationship with God, and it's a God of love and a God of joy.
I think that's true. And the way in the Hindu tradition they talk about this is in terms of bhakti, which means devotion.
Yeah.
So, and it's a very important shift in Hindu tradition from the wisdom traditions to the devotional traditions. So I think that's part of what's going on. But you have to appreciate that even with the Hasidic movement is reacting against a tradition that's quite amazing in terms of its emphasis on learning.
Of course.
Right? And the whole rabbinic tradition in Judaism. And, you know, Christianity has this traditions too, both in Catholicism and Protestantism. But evangelicalism is quite extraordinary for the way it focuses on loving Jesus rather than knowing what he has to say. And one of my arguments is, well, can you really love a person or a God if you don't know what that God or that person stands for?
And we will now turn to the listeners of this program to see what they've got to say about these matters. Some commercials coming in just an instant, and then on to the phones and to the email. And our very special guest of the evening is Stephen Prothero. We are drawing from his new book, Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know and Doesn't. I might add, this is a book that probably every American should read. And apparently, lots of Americans are doing so. Just as of this very day, it ranks about 5 on the Amazon list. Is that right?
It's been in the, between 5 and 10 for the last few days.
And it's going to be the lead story, the cover story, in the next edition of Time magazine.
That's right. I just found that out today. I think it's on the newsstands either today or maybe into the weekend.
Congratulations. But it could not have happened to a worthier and more deserving book. 591-7200. We now go to the first caller. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. And I'm very interested in 1830s New England. And can you say a word about religion and the sea and religion and transcendentalism, such as Emerson and Thoreau, and religion and literature in that 1830s period?
Oh, boy. I could say a lot about that. I do a lot with that in my course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the transcendentalists are really important for understanding American culture. I did a survey recently of courses in American religious history, and I was surprised to see that Emerson and Thoreau had largely dropped off the face of those courses. And I find that a lot of my students are transcendentalists. They just don't know it. They believe that God is inside them. They believe that we should be self-reliant. They don't like to be told what to do by external authorities. They believe that God is to be found more in nature than in institutions. These kinds of themes that you find in Emerson's Essay on Nature or in Thoreau's Walden are really quite prevalent, especially among young people, but even among baby boomers.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything in the religious viewpoint of that period that points toward the sea in any special way?
I don't know what you mean by points toward the sea, the letter C or the ocean, S-E-A?
The ocean. Any special relationship with the sea by America's religions at that time?
Well, I don't know. I really don't know to what you're referring. I know there's a wonderful discussion that Thoreau has about the ice blocks that get chopped from Walden Pond in the winter and get shipped over to India and roll into the Ganges and then out into the ocean in India, and the mingling of East and West, which was one of the real preoccupations that Thoreau's intellectual life.
Mm-hmm. Anything in Melville that relates to religion and the sea?
Well, there's a lot of sea in Melville, surely.
I'm not sure if I'm being quizzed here or what you're really getting at. Maybe if you could be more explicit. But sure, I mean, Melville's battle with Calvinism is a battle with, is a theological battle he plays out with his, you know, character of Ahab and the great white whale. And there's some explicit Calvinist sermons that go on in Moby Dick that you can't understand unless you understand the battle between Calvinists and Unitarians in the early 19th century.
Yes, sir, we thank you for the call.
Okay, thank you.
We must move quickly. Loads of people want to get in on this conversation. Here is the next. On 591-7200, good evening, you're on the air.
Thank you. I was wondering if you thought, if we were more religiously literate, if controversial issues today that we're dealing with might be debated differently, and namely immigration. You know, our southern and western part of our country, we have cities named for, they're not Spanish names, San Antonio and Los Angeles, these are religious names and symbols. And if we were better at understanding, or at least as good at understanding Central America as we were Europe with regard to the Protestant ethic, might it be different?
Yeah, interesting question. How many people know San Francisco refers to St. Francis, right? Those pictures you see of this guy sitting there surrounded by animals. You know, I'm not sure. I think the key thing for me about religious literacy is that we would elevate the conversation. I think that there's a lot of conversation now in politics and in religion that really runs either toward the people on the secular left who are intent on running religion out of the public space, or the people on the religious right who are intent on, you know, ramming religion down our throats. And I think most of us are in the middle, and most of us want to have better conversations when it comes to these questions, instead of somebody just saying, oh, gay marriage is wrong because the Bible says so, and someone saying, oh, that's stupid, don't quote the Bible in public. You know, I wouldn't mind having a conversation that was more biblically literate or religiously literate about immigration or about abortion. Right now, there's sort of sound bites that go on, and there isn't much happening in a lot of these debates.
Our thanks to the caller, and quickly to another. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. When I was in London recently, I talked with a young man who applied for a position teaching religion in a secondary school, and he hoped that his Jesuit education would not work against his application to teach predominantly Muslim students. Now, this is an interesting model for me, teaching religion as really just sort of a humanist subject. And I'm wondering if there's evidence that this contributes to religious literacy and greater civility and civic-mindedness in Great Britain, and also if this might be a model for education in the United States on the secondary level. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
No, stay with us, because this is too interesting. You might have more to say after we get a response from Stephen.
Well, one of the main distinctions that I try to repeat over and over again when people ask me about religion in the public schools is the distinction between preaching religion and teaching about religion. And I am not talking about overturning the Constitution and having teachers start to preach Jesus or preach Allah or preach Jehovah in the classroom. I'm calling for the academic study of religion. Now, this is already happening in high schools and middle schools. We already have modules in eighth grade world history classes, in eighth grade social studies classes about the world's religions. We already have Bible as literature courses in about one out of every 12 American public school districts. So this is happening, and it's very important. It's not happening enough, but it's very important to emphasize this distinction between faith and the academic study of religion. I'm talking about teaching about religion non-devotionally, as objectively as possible, in an academic way.
A common idea these days, whether it's fully correct or not, is that there's a great deal of hostility towards the Western world and towards Christianity on the part of Muslims. This is perhaps only a function of a kind of regression or alteration of Muslim theology and of Muslim practice as it's gone in the Wahhabist direction in recent years. But is it conceivable to you that this person that our caller is talking about, a young man with a Jesuit background teaching religion to largely Islamic students in London, I presume, can possibly affect them for the better in terms of their attitudes towards the Western world and towards, for that matter, the host culture in which they function?
Well, I do think one problem with interreligious violence is ignorance. And there are people who think that if we could just dialogue about religions, everything would be hunky-dory. I tend to think that's a little Pollyanna. But I do think that there's a lot of stereotypes about religious people, and not just about Muslims. I think the atheists in America have a lot of stereotypes about born-again Christians, and born-again Christians have a lot of stereotypes about atheists. And people in England have a lot of stereotypes about Muslims. You know, one thing we don't know a lot about in the West, including the United States, about Islam is, you know, most Muslims aren't living in the Middle East. You know, most are living in South Asia. You know, the largest Muslim country is Indonesia. It's a highly modernized form of Islam. And so it isn't as if all the Muslims in the world are the sort of Al-Qaeda, Wahhabiist Muslims who see other Muslims as heretics and who see Westerners as these horrible people.
But most of the Muslims living in Western Europe and in the UK are of Arab origin and are heavily influenced, particularly the young ones these days, by the revived Wahhabist tradition.
Right. I think that that's true. The other thing I want to say about this issue of education is that I think Americans really missed the boat in terms of putting their troops into Saudi Arabia. I think that when we did that, we should have known. I'm not saying we shouldn't have done it. We shouldn't have kept our troops there in the Middle East after the first Iraq war. But we should have known that if we did it, people were going to be really, really, really mad. And we didn't know that. We didn't. We sort of thought, well, we need this for strategic reasons. But we didn't realize, what is this going to cost us? And I think there, what it cost us was a huge amount. And we didn't know that these are people who see these as their sacred lands. These are people who understand their tradition in the Quran and in the Hadith, the traditions about Muhammad, to be saying that we're not supposed to have infidels in these sacred areas.
Ma'am, back to you. Any further comment from you?
Well, no, I'd just like to say I would not apply for that position. I think that young man is in for a hard time with the parents of his Muslim students.
Quite likely. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
And a pause for a quick update on the news, some commercials, and then directly back to your calls. Here's an interesting email. One common feeling people who are not very religious have is that God is, quote, anti-fun. I'm wondering if your guest has some suggestion on how to change that through religious discussion and education.
Great question. What a wonderful question. Thank you for that. You know, here's the way I would think about that. It would be to test the proposition by actually looking at religions, and if we knew enough about it, we could do it. What's the first miracle that Jesus performs in the Bible? Jesus is at a wedding, it's a party, and the wine is run out. Now, he makes a whole bunch of wine. He makes so much wine, it's staggering. It's the kind of volume of wine that could be used for, you know, a White House inauguration. That doesn't strike me as anti-fun. You go to the Hindu tradition and you look at the god Krishna. Well, one thing Krishna loves to do is to, you know, play the flute. And you look at Shiva. One thing Shiva does in the Hindu tradition is dance. This one of the most iconic images you see in the West of Hindu gods is of Shiva dancing, Shiva Nataraj. So, sure, I think there's an element in religion that says, you know, don't have sex, don't have premarital sex, you know, follow these rules. These are the Ten Commandments. But there's an element in religion that says God is a God of life. God is a God who makes wine. You know, God is a God who plays and dances.
We go back to the phones. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. I was wondering what your guest thought the influence might have been of the influx of so many Roman Catholics in the late 1800s and early 1900s on which has largely been a Protestant nation?
Sure, that's a good question. Well, one of the influences is that we start to think about ourselves less as a Protestant nation and more as a Christian nation. It's interesting now when the religious right talks about Christian America, they don't say Protestant America. That would seem retrograde. And the reason it seems retrograde is because Catholicism became, not even in the late 19th century, by the mid-19th century, Catholicism had become the largest option in terms of denomination in the United States, and obviously changed politics in towns like Chicago, certainly towns like Boston, where I teach. And so that's one thing. I think that what is the religious character of the country? Catholics did that. I mean, Catholics also brought with them, or not brought with them, but they were greeted with tremendous hostility by Protestants. And the history of violence in America very much runs through anti-Catholicism and Protestant opposition to Catholics. And the ways in which Protestants respond to Catholics and the stereotypes they have of Catholics actually carry over into stereotypes about other groups, including Mormons and even Hindus in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. One thing I can say, having been raised Catholic, with the Catholic Church emphasizes not just scripture, but tradition and the teaching of the magisterium. And I have to admit that we have been guilty in not knowing our scripture as well as we should.
Well, and not knowing the scripture, but also not knowing the tradition. I ask students about the Catholic sacraments, and they have a hard time with that, even my Catholic students. And there's a lot of discussion in Catholic circles about Catholic illiteracy.
Right.
And what are we as Catholics going to do a better job with our CCD classes, our religious education classes? How can we teach kids better about the Bible, better about the history of the Catholic Church? Most religious traditions, it's interesting, in the United States, no, I'm not hearing from evangelicals that, oh, we know the Bible really well. I'm not hearing from Jews saying, oh, we have no problem with Jewish illiteracy. People inside religious traditions know what they don't know.
Right.
And I think that's part of where the book is resonating.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you,
sir, for the call. You bring to my mind the memory of an odd night on this very program. Quite a number of years ago, three nuns were my guests. They were from a particular order, and they were all sort of given to the social gospel and to good works, and they were modern nuns. They weren't wearing nuns' habit, but they were busy, and they had been nuns lifelong. And at some point, I got them talking, or tried to get them talking about theology and about Catholic belief, and I said, well, let's just track it out. Do you really accept all of the items in the Apostles' Creed? Would one of you please recite the Apostles' Creed? Let's examine that. And one of them laughed and said, we don't bother with that. And I said, well, could you recite the Apostles' Creed? She said, I don't think I could remember it. And the other two agreed. And a firestorm of rage was generated on the part of listeners, good Catholic listeners, who were astonished and really dismayed that these sisters no longer took the Apostles' Creed seriously.
Well, one of the arguments I make in the book is about the drift in American religion, including American Protestantism and Judaism and Catholicism, toward good works, toward what you're calling the social gospel. Mm-hmm. In the Catholic tradition, I've asked my students, what do you learn in your CCD classes? Because mm-hmm. most of the Catholic kids have taken these classes. And when I asked, the first thing I heard was color. They learned to color, because they would color pictures of Jesus or mm-hmm. Mary or something. And then the second thing was social service. Social service is very, very much emphasized in these classes. And the kids will go out and they'll work in soup kitchens or homeless shelters, which is really a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. But while they're doing that instead of, like you say, learning the creeds of the church, learning something, say, about the papacy, learning something about the sacraments, what makes Catholics different from Protestants when it comes to sacramentalism. These kinds of things that would make a Catholic know why he or she is a Catholic. I have a friend who teaches at a seminary in the South who teaches ministers-to-be. And she tells me that Methodist ministers in training come in knowing nothing about the Methodist tradition, mm-hmm. knowing not at all why Methodists are different from Lutherans, indeed why they should even be a Methodist minister. Mm-hmm. But there they are getting ready to become ministers in a tradition that they know nothing about. This is sort of shocking to me.
Do pastors in the Calvinist tradition these days really even understand and or take seriously the doctrine of predestination?
You know what? I'm going to say yes. I know I'm supposed to be saying that everybody knows nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the difference about that Calvinist tradition, the Reformed tradition, which lingers in, say, Presbyterianism and other forms of Reformed theology, is that that is a tradition that has staked its identity on its doctrinal differences from other Christians. And so I do suspect, I don't know this is true, but I do suspect that not only ministers in that Calvinist side of American Christianity, but also ordinary people have a sense that we, not necessarily we believe that God has predestined us for heaven and hell before we're born, but at least that that's what our tradition says. I think it's hard for Americans to believe that. It seems quite unfair, but I think that they at least know their tradition stands for that. At least some of them do.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones. 591-7200. Good evening. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
My call has to do with Iraq right now. And the way Muslims think of the Quran has a lot of political consequences. And many Muslims now in Iraq confuse the teachings of the Quran and the Haditha. Is my observation correct? I will hang up and let you answer. Thank you.
All right, sir. Thank you for the call.
Okay, I think the question was, do Muslims in Iraq confuse the teachings of the Quran with the teachings of the Hadith, which have to do with the sayings of Muhammad and sayings by Muhammad's companions about Muhammad, and that really point to the example of Muhammad? And you know what? I just don't know the answer to that question. I suppose that they do. I suppose that this is something that believers in almost every tradition have trouble with, is knowing where things come from. I think more broadly, I think Muslims sometimes confuse the cultural teachings that are surrounding them with the religious teachings, but I don't want to single out Muslims there because American Christians do that all the time too. I heard a colleague of mine recently talking about how students were telling her that Jesus, Catholic students were telling her that Jesus tells us not to have premarital sex. Well, Jesus may say that if he were alive today and we could ask him, but he never says in the Bible, don't have premarital sex. That's the kind of thing that the church is telling these kids, and then they're using the authority of Jesus, or the kids are getting confused. So I wouldn't be surprised if there was some confusion like that in Iraq. The key thing about Iraq to me now for Americans is knowing some basic differences about, there's different kinds of Muslims there, and what do Muslims care about? What motivates them to try to make peace and to try to kill? This is the kind of thing that politicians need to know in America, and that American citizens who elect these politicians need to know something about.
We are due for a last round of commercials, and quickly back to the phones and to the next caller. You are on the air. Good evening. Hello,
hey,
are you there? Yes, sir.
Hey, Milt, this is Jim, and I want to tell you, you got a great show, but, you know, we got to get you on earlier in the evening. You're just on way too late.
Please give us your serious question or comment, sir.
Well, the serious question is that, you know, your speaker's talking about the Catholic religion and how we don't know the scripture, but, you know, that's not the intention of the Catholic religion. You know, the Catholic religion is a religion of doing, you know, not just reading and reciting scripture. I mean, that's a whole big difference from a lot of the other religions that he's talking about.
How do you know it's a religion of doing? How does one find out that it's a religion of doing? If it's not by listening to the tradition, by reading the scripture, by listening to sermons by priests. In other words, that comes from somewhere. It comes from the Gospel of Luke. And if you don't know the Gospel of Luke and you don't know what Jesus says there, it becomes an odd thing. You know, why are we running around doing these good things for people? Is it because God is a certain sort of God? Is it because Jesus is a certain sort of person?
No, we do that as Catholics because we know that we are loved. We are loved by God, and our reaction to that love is by doing something. I mean, you know, that's how you demonstrate your love, is by doing something. I mean, you know, that's a whole different thing. You know, we are not like the Muslims that believe that they believe that they are succumbing to God's will. That, you know, theirs is a different thing. They could do good things because they believe that they're going to earn their way into heaven. Catholics don't believe that. Catholics believe in love. And, you know, that's probably why we're not really good at, you know, the scripture, reciting scripture.
Yeah, I'm not besmirching love. I hope I'm not coming out against love here tonight, or against social service. I'm just making an observation, and you could decide, frankly, that it's a good thing that Catholics have forgotten what it is to be Catholic. I'm not sure it's a good thing, but one could make that decision. I'm more talking about why it is, and this isn't true just about Catholics, because the same, Milt was talking earlier about the social gospel and Protestantism. This is happening with Protestants too, that the doctrinal and the teaching sides of religion and the narrative sides, understanding the symbols, understanding what the tradition has taught, has gone away for a focus on morality and a focus on experience.
It is true, is it not, that a real difference between Catholicism and many of the different modes of Protestantism is the Catholic stress on good works, and that the road to heaven, the road to a heavenly destination, is in fact available to the will of the individual.
Well, right. I think that's where, in one respect, I disagree with the caller saying, you know, we don't believe that you get to heaven by doing good works. I mean, that's one thing that John Kerry brought up in his campaign, you know, that he said, listen, you know, one thing that Catholics believe is we believe that, you know, faith without works is dead. And that's what he used to justify his emphasis on certain democratic social programs. So I think that's there in the Catholic tradition. It's a basic distinction between Catholics and Protestants.
We will go directly back to the phones, and you are next on the air. Good evening.
Hello. Mine's more about the origins of Catholicism. I'm a student of classical studies, and it just seems like so much of the Catholic, or more along the lines, Christian religion has been fabricated and taken from pagan history. Some of the holidays, for example, some of the miracles that Jesus performed seem directly taken from Greek and Roman myths. I often have to think of the Catholic religion or the Christian religion as the Roman wolf in sheep's clothing. I was wondering what you might be able to say about that.
You know, this is what used to annoy my grandfather to no end about Christianity, and I have frankly never understood it. Because I'm a historian, and I know that history is, you know, one thing after another, and the things build up upon one another and influence one another. So I have never suspected that there would be any religion that would be you know, bereft of historical influence before it. So the fact that Christians borrowed from Romans and borrowed from the Greeks as well and borrowed from the Jews seems to me an obvious truth rather than a shocking thing. I mean, the alternative is to expect that a religion would just spring out of nothing as if nothing had existed in history before. But that's absolutely, it's absolutely true that, sure, that you know, why did Christmas come when it did? Well, not because the Bible says it was December 25th, but because, you know, there were traditions about around the winter solstice, and that's the way it went. That really troubled my grandfather. That was one thing that ran him out of the church, but it so doesn't trouble me.
One of the best ways to illustrate that, I should think, would be with regard to Islam, which is clearly a rewriting of the materials of Hebrew Bible and the New Testament.
Well, that's part of it. You have to be careful because, you know, these are traditions that believe in revelation.
To be sure.
So, and this same...
But there would be no Islam without a prior Judaism and Christianity.
Well, the way I'd put it is that the historical way to look at this, as opposed to the theological way, the historical way to look at it is that Islam most definitely draws on influences from both Judaism and Christianity. And the way the Muslims say it is that their God is the same God as the God of the Christians and the Jews. And so it would make sense that those
historical
parallels would be there.
But their prophets were incomplete. It required Muhammad to become the seal of the prophets, giving the final truth.
That's right. Incomplete might be the wrong word, but the prophets were speaking for their own time, and that we finally got around to the final prophet, who is Muhammad. That's the view, yes.
Here's another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
First, an observation. When I remember in Jeopardy, when I was a child in the early 70s, that when the category Bible came up, everyone buzzed in on that right away. And now when the category of the Bible comes up, it's always the last one
selected. Yes, they avoid it like the plague. They do.
Yes.
Very interesting observation, yes.
I wanted to respond to the comment about the Calvinism and the Reformed traditions. Unlike most Protestant denominations, the more conservative you get in the Reformed churches, the more they do teach the catechisms and the creeds, and even instruct about, for example, what Catholics believe so that you can understand the difference between their religion and the Catholic doctrines. And I've been both in the Reformed churches and the Holiness churches. And when you get more conservative in the Holiness churches, if anything, they know less about their doctrinal tradition.
Right, and I think part of that is because the identity is doctrinal in the Calvinist or Reformed side, and the identity is more experiential in the Holiness side. We've had this experience of, say, the second birth or speaking in tongues or something like that, that's what makes us Holiness people, sanctification, right? But what makes us Calvinists is that we believe these certain things about predestination.
Yes.
And so there's an imperative to teach the doctrine, whereas in the more experiential traditions, there's less imperative to teach the stories and the symbols and the characters in the Bible and things like that.
Okay, thank you.
We thank you, sir. Let me read you this interesting email that I've got in front of me. Could you comment on religions, specifically Christianity's ingenious ability to incorporate itself into what they might otherwise have to reject? An example, the Song of Solomon or Song of Songs is in both the Catholic and Protestant canons and even has the exalted status of an allegory for Christ's love for his church. But this book of the Bible started out as secular or pagan love poetry, unmistakably erotic, though not pornographic. Do you agree that...
Well, part of the premise of the question is that eros and eroticism shouldn't be part of religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eros is part of human life, and sexuality is part of human life. And I'm grateful that the Bible has some sexy stuff in it. You know, it's a wonderful book. Why should we think that the Bible should be, you know, to go back to fun, you know, why should we think the Bible can't have some fun in it and that Christianity can't have positive views of human sexuality?
I am surprised that no caller came through with this very simple question. Are you a believing Christian?
You want me to answer that?
I do.
It's a question I try to avoid with my students because we want to be as objective as possible as mm-hmm. religious studies people. I describe myself as a confused Christian, and I think what I mean by that is that I'm a Christian in that I was raised in the Episcopal tradition. I go to church on occasion, probably not as much as I should. And I have a hard time believing a lot of the creedal things in the tradition because I find them a little fantastic because I'm a modern person. But the stories resonate with me. And when I get in trouble in my life or when I have good experiences in my life, I tend to race toward Christian stories. And I guess that's what makes me a Christian. As far as being a believing Christian, I guess I'm not as good as a believer as I ought to be because I have a hard time believing.
Well, you've dealt in religious scholarship for many, many years, all the way from your graduate student years to the present, and you are essentially an historian of religion, particularly of American religion. Did that somehow weaken or at least deflect your faith?
No, I think what happened with my own faith is that I had a period in my life when I was younger where I had a lot more answers than I had questions when it came to religion. And I think as I grew older, the questions multiplied and the answers didn't multiply as fast. And I think it's actually that fact, that my confusion, in other words, that led me into the study of religion, because I was so interested in the questions. And I found that doing religious history was a way to hang in with those questions and keep them alive.
Well, the outcome of what you were led into has been some fine work. And the most recent book by Stephen Prothero is the one we've been talking about and drawing from tonight, Religious Literacy, What Every American Needs to Know and Doesn't. I believe I did not yet say that's published by Harper San Francisco and available wherever real books are sold.